Hello there, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Audacious Aotearoa. This is your host, Christopher Carroll, and this week I'm going to be interviewing Liam Collins, who's a former colonel in the United States Army, a Special Forces officer who served combat deployments in Afghanistan, Iraq. He worked alongside now-retired General John Aberdeen, who was the senior defense advisor to Ukraine, and he's going to talk to us today about reform of Ukraine's military since 2014 and how it's contributed to Ukraine's success in fighting Russian forces at the present moment. Liam Collins, welcome to Audacious Aotearoa. It's great to have you with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So in the past, you've conducted fieldwork in Georgia. I'm really curious what happened there with Russia. What did you learn from this research, and how did it inform the changes that happened in Ukraine from 2014 onwards?
Yeah, so Russia, right, invaded Georgia in 2008, and they learned many things that they kind of implemented later in 2014 to perfection. So similar to 2014, they lined large number of troops up on the border, right? After an exercise, they didn't go home. They were sitting on the border. What they tried to do is paint the invasion as a picture of responsibility to protect. They were going to protect ethnic Russians and South Ossetians from Georgian genocide, which of course didn't hold any credibility. And what they learned was, right, they sent their formations across the border. The war was instigated by Georgia preemptively attacking into South Ossetia to prevent the Russians from coming through the tunnel in the gorge. But ultimately, everybody saw it for the most part for what it was, a preemptive war. Again, with Russia, it was trying to prevent Georgia from joining NATO. But some of the tactics we saw is, right, implementing electronic warfare and cyber warfare and electronic warfare to cripple the communication systems between Tbilisi, the capital, and the troops in the field. Georgia is an extremely small country, small military. They only had three brigades. One was actually overseas supporting coalition operations. They only had two. So they were not going to, you know, Russia was just going to overwhelm them. And so it was a short fight, 5 days. But in a tactical level, the Georgians outperformed the Russians. It was just the Russians had the mass. And then we also see in terms of the air war, Georgia shot down in the five-day war 22 Russian aircraft. So Russia was pretty surprised by that. And really, so going into 2014, what Russia learned, some of the key lessons was sending large formations across the border is not deniable, right? Not plausibly deniable. You can, it's responsibility to protect or anything else. And so that's why they sent little green men in Ukraine in 2014. And they really focused on improving their information operations, right? To put disinformation, other things out there, not necessarily to get anybody to, you know, want to, you know, love Russia, but just put enough disinformation out there so people don't know what to believe. So those were kind of the big things coming out of 2008.
And so you've mentioned already some of the air defenses, and in particular, Ukraine's is one that's got a lot of commentation associated with it, given that there was the expectation that the Ukrainian Air Force was going to be obliterated fairly quickly. But yet, weeks on and a month now, we're still seeing the Ukrainian Air Force play a major role in Ukraine. How did Ukraine get to that point of preparation to where it is now of being able to sustain its Air Force for as long as it has?
Yeah, I mean, I can't get a good sense of how significant their Air Force has been, but I thought it would be grounded within the first 2 days of war. In 2014, they pretty much grounded their Air Force. They couldn't use their helicopters to evacuate citizens or you know, members that were hurt in the Donbas in the conflict. So they lost a lot of casualties because they wouldn't fly close because they'd get shot down. So they would ground them, you know, ground evac to the helicopter and then try to fly them out. And so that has actually been a surprise. I did not expect that given Russian air defense systems. But on the other side, I haven't been surprised by the fact that, you know, Ukraine's been able to shoot down or as many as they report, but even if it's less, I haven't been surprised by the fact that they've been able to down Russian aircraft again, because all you had to do is look at Georgia to see that and how Georgia performed. And then with, you know, the West providing Stinger anti-aircraft missiles and other anti-aircraft missiles, I thought Russia would then withhold its, it obviously has withheld its number of sorties, but Russia is still flying and still getting aircraft shot down.
How's the United States used training, aid, and partnerships with neighboring NATO countries to assist Ukraine? And how effective has this been?
Yep. I mean, first of all, it's not a NATO effort. It's kind of a coalition of the willing, and it's primarily U.S., U.K., Canada, and Lithuania, and maybe a few others, but they're providing the bulk of the training effort. And that's really started late 2014 and grew since then. And so keep in mind, at that time, they were fighting a war in the East. So they're trying to train a force with a decrepit military, really train it from scratch, from basically nothing, and train a force that's capable of, you know, fighting and withholding. But I went over there from 2016 to 2018, helping them reform their defense establishment. And it was clear their focus was really defending against a large-scale Russian invasion. So they wanted to build a force that was capable of that. And they realized having an old Soviet-style military would not work. You need to have one that is trained, empowers leaders at the lower level to exercise what we call discipline initiative on the battlefield, basically seize the initiative. And that effort has really paid off, as we've seen in 2022 in the recent invasion, of how far they've come.
So how has the United States played a role in reshaping the Ukrainian military since 2014?
Yeah, and first and foremost, this is a Ukrainian effort. They want to reform. They made it a priority. They conducted a review of their defense establishments and identified significant shortfalls. And the President Poroshenko at the time enacted the Strategic Defense Bulletin of Ukraine in 2016, mandating broad and sweeping reform across the defense establishment. And so, you can't force someone to reform if they don't want to reform, right? So they've asked for this help, and it's, you know, a mix of things, right? Advisors at various levels in their Ministry of Defense, to inform, in terms of medical, how do they improve their medical capabilities? Because it needed major overhaul, their logistics, their personnel, So various systems like that, the strategic communications, all these kind of things. And then you had the training effort that was going on concurrent to that, and then still limited assistance in terms of weaponry and equipment. And then we were kind of at the senior advisor level. I was working with General Abizay. We were kind of looking at everything collectively and providing our thoughts and recommendations on that.
Yeah. Reflecting on that, do you feel like there were any missed opportunities that would again provide a learning curve going forward in a similar situation?
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt, I think if Ukraine would have been better armed or Russia would have understood Ukraine's capabilities, then they could have deterred them, right? The key is we and the West and Ukraine wanted to deter Russian aggression to begin with, because it's to nobody's benefit to have Russia go in there, take a pounding, pound the city, kill hundreds or thousands of people, cause billions of dollars of damage to ultimately pull out, right? That's not in Russia's interest, not in Ukraine's interest. And so I think there, we could have, armed them more. But going back to 2014 and 2016, there was a real fear, at least in the Obama administration, if we provided what they called lethal aid at the time, then somehow it would escalate and then have the opposite effect of actually Russia response would then be to actually invade Ukraine. So there was a lot of, discussions among senior level policy officials about what that would be, and a belief by many that more aid would actually cause Russia to invade.
So you've mentioned training, and there's a reserve army component clearly attached to what Ukraine's been able to achieve. Having a reserve army and the ability to train civilians quickly can be a game changer. And in a conflict like the one playing out at the moment, how has the Ukrainian military prepared and utilized reserve soldiers for real effect in this conflict?
You're right. I mean, maintaining a large standing military is prohibitively expensive. And so, they got to have a core active duty military. And what they've done, I wouldn't say so much their reserves, but it's so much what they're calling volunteers. So it's a territorial defense force of volunteers that are really civilians, less so than reserves that have had, active training in the military. And then maybe they're out of the military and then they form reserves in a lot of countries. This is purely a volunteer force. But it shouldn't come as a surprise. In 2014, when Russian supported separatists in the East, volunteers flocked out there with their weapons, whatever camouflage uniforms they could find, anything, they went out there and helped them hold off the Russian-backed separatists while the military improved its capability and built up. And so they have a culture for this. So Last year, they enacted legislation that went into effect this year that created that territorial defense force to basically formalize something that was an ad hoc thing. And then, right, they could provide guidance and those kind of things. So, again, it's hard to figure out exactly how much or how significant of a role they played by the very nature, because of how reformed Ukraine's military establishment is. They don't have to have that same role that they had back in 2014 when they were actually, holding the front in many places. And so I would think, they're probably providing, kind of low level guerrilla type attacks, maybe ambushes, right? Providing intelligence, right? I mean, just think of if you got tens or hundreds of thousands of sensors out there effectively, providing that intelligence then so that, again, because now they're integrated into the military, that then the Ukrainian armed forces can act on it. So I think they're playing definitely playing a role in this conflict. And then as they go into the cities, right, play a more active role in that as well.
So you mentioned President Petro and the reforms that he advocated for in 2016. I'm just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what these reforms were and how you think they played out into the current success Ukraine is seeing in fighting Russian forces at the present moment.
I mean, like I said, they were broad and sweeping reforms that President Poroshenko, mandated from command and control, planning, like operational employment, logistics and medical, and professionalizing the force. So again, right, the medical, for example, they had a military system and a civilian system that were incompatible with one another. And as a result, a lot of soldiers died on the front. Because they weren't evacuated in time, within the golden hour, and it just took them too long to get them evacuated. So they've obviously improved that to a significant level, because I haven't seen anything in the news about anybody talking about the Ukrainians' inability to evacuate or take care of their wounded. So that's just one. Another one is their logistical system was terrible back in 2014, and we see the opposite this time, right? It's the Russians that are having problems. And I've known people that have gone over there as part of this international volunteer battalion or brigade or whatever it is. And as soon as they showed up, they got Ukrainian uniforms, Ukrainian rifles. So their logistical system is obviously working. And then again, you can just look at their wartime performance, compare and contrast 2014 to today. And it's clear, right? Their command and control, their operations and their planning are clearly working.
Yeah, right. The other thing you talked about in your article for The Conversation is how those lower level soldiers were given an opportunity to adapt their approach based on what was happening at the present moment, rather than follow a strict command structure that didn't allow for the adaptivity in the field. Can you just talk a little bit about how that occurred and how that's so important at the present moment?
We first went over there for the first meeting with their minister of defense. General Abbas aide told me, hey, they're going to be very Soviet. I'm like, I don't know what that means to be a Soviet military. Well, at the first meeting, the minister of defense opens up a book, reads for about 15 minutes, closes it. And, he's lined up on the end of this long table with all his advisors, four-star generals, and General Abbas aide and myself sitting on the other side. They close the book and it's done. And I'm like, I thought this was a meeting. That was just reading a script. But that's kind of what it was like, right? All decisions have to go to the highest level before you can do anything. There is no independent ability to make decisions at a lower level. And so what they learned through two things, one was the fight in the Donbas. They realized, hey, we can't let all the decisions go up to the general, right? Speed of battle is too fast in the 21st century. Lower level leaders have to be empowered to make, seize the initiative on the battlefield. And also at the same time, we were enforcing that concept in training out in Yavoriv at the Joint Military Training Group Ukraine, where we were training battalions as they were coming through there, up to five battalions a year. So inculcating a generation of officers over 8 years of what we call discipline initiative at the lower level. And that's, we're seeing that play out now, right? So again, Russia has overwhelming combat power, but at the tactical level, just like we saw in Georgia, but much more significant here, we're seeing them outperform the Russians every time in the tactical level, because they have this. And it's not something as simple as you can just say, hey, lower level leaders are empowered. You have to train them, educate, put trust in them, all these things to make it work. And part of their professionalization of the force that's allowed them to do that.
Yeah. Because, there's an argument to be made, I guess, that morale is so high and the civilian population is so heavily in favor of the defense of Ukraine that sort of brought us to the present moment where Ukraine's been able to do what they've currently done. But there's also, I guess, an argument that that's too simplistic of a view of what's actually going on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, if you look at war fighting performance as a function of many things, right? It's, strategy, operational employment, doctrine, training, and then the actual weapon systems and the size of the army. So the only thing, and will, and right, resolve, the will to fight. And the only thing Russia has an edge in is, right, forces, right? They have some overwhelming number of forces, weapon systems, but in every other capability, right, or every other variable, right, Ukraine has an advantage, and in some cases an overwhelming advantage. As you mentioned, kind of the will to fight, right? Ukraine's will to fight is overwhelming advantage over Russia. These soldiers were on the border for months. They were sent, it's clear by the intelligence or that, the captured Russians, when they were sent across the border to invade, they had no idea what the purpose of the invasion was. Putin still hasn't communicated to them. They have no idea why they're going to Russia, why they're dying for their nation. And so their morale is pretty low. Meanwhile, the Ukrainians, their will is the will to fight is extremely high. They saw what happened in 2014, right? And they've never, after 8 years, the Donbass is still, they have not gotten it back. And so they don't want to lose any more of their nation. And they've seen the disaster of what living under, Russian influence in the Donbass is like, right? No civil liberties, no economic opportunity. Nobody wants that. So they're going to fight extremely hard. And I think that's across the country and the diaspora. And that's why we see people coming back and Ukrainian diaspora to fight for them, because they're extremely motivated to not let Russia take it over and make it a Soviet satellite or a Russian satellite like Belarus. And so they're going to fight hard.
So looking at the Ukrainian military, I mean, granted what is going on at the moment, going forward, where do you think the room is for further reform and for further change within the Ukrainian military to make it more effective?
I mean, I think they probably, there's always things you can do on the margins. I haven't been there recently to see. I mean, but it looks like they're fighting fairly well. There was still a lot of, too many things when we left were opaque in terms of, right, logistics and purchasing weapons. And then that allows potential for corruption, and corruption effectively, right, means you're wasting 5 to 10% of what you're spending. I don't know what it is now, or those were just arbitrary numbers I was just saying, but they need to be more transparent about their military and where they're spending money to ensure you don't have the opportunities for corruption. And that's one of the big things, but otherwise, it looks like, they've kind of formalized this territorial defense force, right? So you don't have just volunteers fighting out there on their own, incorporating them into a military system that fights within, the laws of warfare. So I don't have any specific recommendations on where they can improve based on what we've seen.
Yeah, that's all good. Using the reform of Ukraine's military as a case study, where do you think this model could be applied elsewhere in the world, and how important could reforms made in Ukraine's military be for the next conflict that breaks out?
Yeah, keep in mind, I mean, as I talked earlier, right, reforms have to be self-generated. They have to want to reform, right? Clearly, that's why it didn't work in Afghanistan, Iraq, right? These nations were never behind building a large military. And we tried to build them, design a military that didn't work for their environment. This is a country, right, that has an enemy that they didn't realize they had until 2014. So they're incentivized to reform and fix the military, root out corruption, get rid of people that aren't, that don't need to be there anymore. And so I don't think there's, in terms of helping them reform, I mean, one of the lessons, shouldn't be a lesson, it should be obvious, but, reform the military for something, or build a military that works for their political, cultural, social environment, which is not what happened in Afghanistan or Iraq. And here it was really just kind of not trying to build it in the US image, but trying to improve their military that fits for the Ukrainian culture and their political system for what it is. So, I mean, that's one of the lessons to take away from this.
Yeah, right, that makes sense. It's context specific. Yeah, cool. Hey, Liam, thank you so much for talking to us today. It's been great to have a chat with you.
Yeah, no problem. Just shoot me the link once you got it up there.